Chapter 9, From Shyampukur to the Close. The home of Balaram Bose sheltered Sri Ramakrishna in Calcutta until a suitable house for rent was found. Balaram's home and family were blessed by the association and that of the Master's great disciples in succeeding years, and have served the Ramakrishna Mott and Mission even to this day. Soon the devotees found a spacious house on the north side of Shyampukur Street in northern Calcutta. To a large room upstairs in this house, Sri Ramakrishna was now moved, and it is here that he experienced the visions we have next to relate. The time of the autumn festival of the Divine Mother had arrived, the Durga Puja, celebrated with great joy, especially in Bengal, at the house of Surendranath Mitra, a disciple of the Master, much devoted to the Devi. The three-day worship had been arranged with great care and loving anticipation. Alas, the beloved Guru was ill and could not attend the worship in person. However, in the latter's room, on the third evening of the worship, another kind of festivity was going on. Many people had gathered there, among them Dr. Mahendra Sarkar, who now had charge of the treatment of Sri Ramakrishna's throat. Songs sung by Narendra had created a holy atmosphere felt by all, and Sri Ramakrishna was repeatedly experiencing Bhava Samadhi. At about 7:30 p.m., he stood up to bid goodbye to the doctor, who was leaving, when he fell into deep Samadhi. Some whispered that this was due to the auspiciousness of the hour, a point in the Durga Puja which was especially sacred. Dr. Sarkar sat down again to witness the scene. After about half an hour had passed, Sri Ramakrishna returned to the sense plane and revealed the fact that he had in vision visited the worship of Surendra's house. He says, "I saw a luminous path connecting this place and Surendra's house. I found that through Surendra's devotion, the mother was manifest in the image, her third eye shooting forth a divine light. The usual series of lamps was burning in front, and Surendra, sitting in the courtyard, was weeping bitterly before the mother." The Master added, "You had better go there. He will be comforted to see you." Narendra, ever the rationalist and skeptic, then went with other devotees to Surendra's house and found the details to be as described. M, in his Gospel, notes the events of the following day, which is called Vijaya Day, on which the image of the Divine Mother is immersed in the river. Surendra, who had been taking very much to heart the melancholy of the mother's departure, arrived at the Shyampukur house for consolation. Yesterday evening at 7 or 7:30, Sri Ramakrishna informed him, "I saw your worship hall in the vision. I saw the divine image full of effulgence. This place and your hall were joined by a stream of light flowing between them." Surendra replied, "At that time I was crying to the mother in the worship hall. My elder brothers had gone upstairs. I thought the mother said, 'I will come again.'" No more about the incident is reported here, but in Sister Deva Mata's book, Sri Ramakrishna, Swami Ramakrishnananda's version is given, in which it is said that Surendra distinctly saw the Master there at that time. If so, he apparently did not mention it in the above conversation, where we might expect it. A few days later, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Sri Ramakrishna was sitting on his bed, a few devotees nearby, when a peculiar mood of maternal affection struck him. Putting his pillow on his lap, he began to caress it and hold it to his breast as if it were his child. Yet his face was lighted with a childlike smile. He changed the arrangement of his wearing cloth. The devotees watched him amazed. Evidently, he went into Bhava Samadhi, and shortly after sense consciousness returned, he confided to M his experience. There was a meadow covering an area of 7 or 8 miles, through which lay the road to Sihor. I was alone in that meadow. I saw a 16-year-old Paramahamsa boy, exactly like the one I had seen in the Panchavati. A mist of bliss lay all around. Out of it emerged a boy 13 or 14 years old. I saw his face. He looked like Purna. Both of us were naked. Then we began to run around joyfully in the meadow. Purna felt thirsty. He drank some water from a tumbler and offered me what was left. I said to him, "Brother, I cannot take your leavings." Thereupon he laughed, washed the glass, and brought me fresh water. We have given the Master's own words, but one cannot help wishing that he had said something more about this vision. Apparently, the Paramahamsa boy, seen in the Panchavati, refers to the young sannyasin who symbolized his own person, since after the beginning of this vision, there are only two figures in it. Some may feel that there is a relation between this vision and the Master's next remark. He first returns to Samadhi, and coming out of it, tells M, "My mind is undergoing a change. I cannot take prasad anymore. The real and the appearance are becoming one to me." Does he mean that the Purna-like boy in the vision represents the Lord, and that he, Sri Ramakrishna, can no longer accept the leavings even of the Lord, because he is now feeling the identity of the real, that is God, and the appearance, that is, the whole relative world, including his own body and mind? Meanwhile, another vision had intervened. During his return to Samadhi, "Do you know what I saw just now?" he went on to say. "The Divine Mother appeared with a child in her womb, to which she soon gave birth. The next moment, she began to devour it, and as much of the child as went into her mouth became void. It was revealed to me that everything is void." This, the reader will perhaps recognize as a repetition or variant of the vision Sri Ramakrishna had had more than 20 years earlier, which has been cited in Chapter 3. On the evening of this day, October 23rd, 1885, many devotees gathered as usual around his bed. Among them this evening was Girish Ghosh, the actor, manager, and playwright, who had recently come into the Master's coterie. To entertain Sri Ramakrishna, he had brought from the Star Theatre the actor and singer Ram Taran. Presently, Ram Taran sang two songs from the play Life of Buddha, which Ramakrishna had seen when he attended its performance at the theater. Both the play and its songs were written by Girish, based on some passages from Edwin Arnold's Light of Asia. The second song concluded with the following words, which seemed to be a prayer addressed to Lord Buddha. Burst thou our slumber's bars, O thou that art awake. How long must we remain enmeshed in fruitless dreams? Are you indeed awake? Then do not longer sleep. Thick on you lies the gloom fraught with a million woes. Rise, dreamer, from your dream, and slumber not again. Shine forth, O shining one, and with thy shafts of light slay thou the blinding dark. Our only Savior thou, we seek deliverance at thy feet. The moment the singer came to the words, Shine forth, O shining one, and with thy shafts of light slay thou the blinding dark, Sri Ramakrishna went into samadhi, beholding a vision of the sun. As he arose, the master told the company, the darkness vanished, and all men sought refuge at his feet. We are here reminded of a vision which was brought to our notice too late to be included in its chronological place. Sometime after the master's first acquaintance with Trailokyanath Sanyal, singer and composer of the Brahmo Samaj, the latter sang for the master his own song, which begins with the line, In wisdom's firmament, the moon of love is rising full. Sri Ramakrishna saw a living, large, full moon. Whenever the song was sung thereafter, it would throw him into ecstasy. Some days later, the master was informed in vision about two men who were to have spiritual awakening. It was dusk, at which time it was Ramakrishna's custom to sit upon his bed, chanting the name of God, or otherwise absorbed in contemplation of him. This day he was able to forget all about the pain in his throat, so deeply was he immured in the inner world. Regaining consciousness after a long time, he whispered to M that he had completely merged in the indivisible Brahman. After that, he had seen many things. Dr. Sharkar was to have much knowledge, dry knowledge, he said. But he would soften in time. He had seen another man and said, the master, My mind said to me, attract him too. I shall tell you about him later. The latter proved eventually to be a cousin of Balaram Bose, Hari Ballav by name, whom he had recently met for the first time and to whom he had shown affection. Both of these men, Dr. Sharkar and Hari Ballav, scoffers at first, soon learned to revere. The doctor was a good man who often deplored the display of emotion sometimes taking place in the master's company. But one day, seeing the doctor so joyful after hearing one of Narendra's songs, Sri Ramakrishna told him the story of the son who had taken to wine. The boy had said in reply to his remonstrating father, You please taste a little wine, and after that, if you ask me to give up drinking, I shall do so. After drinking some wine, the father said, Son, you may give it up. I have no objection. I certainly am not going to give it up. Swami Sharadananda tells us that one day at Shyampukur, Sri Ramakrishna was teaching a young visitor the proper postures for the various types of meditation on God. Sitting in the lotus posture and placing the back of his right hand on the palm of his left, he drew the hands up to his breast and shut his eyes. This is the best posture for all kinds of meditation on God with form, he said. Then, still in Padmasana, he placed his right and left hands on his right and left knees, respectively, touching tips of thumb and forefinger in each hand. The other fingers were straight, and his gaze was fixed between the eyebrows. And this is the best posture for meditation on God without form, said the master. And at once he plunged into samadhi. Before long, he seemed to be forcing the mind back to the normal plane. I couldn't show you any more, he said. As soon as I sit in that posture, the mind becomes absorbed and merges in samadhi. The pranas go upward, and the sore in my throat is aggravated. Hence the doctor has forbidden samadhi. The young man was very sorry. He said, Sir, you shouldn't have shown me these things. I did not ask for them. True, Sri Ramakrishna replied, but I could not help giving you a little practical training. It reminds one of the previous occasion, which similarly indicates how his mind behaved in entering samadhi. Today, he had said on that occasion, I shall tell you everything and not keep anything secret. He clearly described the yogic centers of the body and their corresponding experiences up to the throat. Then, pointing to the spot between the eyebrows, he said, when the mind reaches this point, one catches a vision of the Paramatman, the Supreme Self, and falls into samadhi. There, only a thin, transparent veil separates the Supreme Self and the individual self. He was about to say next, but he went into samadhi all at once. Coming down a little, he tried again to describe it, but he was again in samadhi. Finally, with tears in his eyes, the master said, Well, I sincerely wish to convey everything to you, holding nothing back. But mother will not allow me to speak. She was pressing my mouth. You see, he said, something rises with a tingling sensation from the feet to the head. So long as it does not reach the head, I remain conscious. But the moment it does so, I am dead to the outside world. There is no seeing or hearing any more, not to mention speaking. Who could speak? The very idea of I and you vanishes. While that power is going up, I feel like telling you everything, my visions and all, until it comes here, the heart, or at most here, the throat. Speaking is possible, and I do speak. But when it goes beyond the throat, someone stops my mouth, as it were. As I think over what I will say, up goes the mind at a bound, and there is an end to the matter. As a typical illustration of this, we shall take a scene at Dakshineswar in April of 1885. The master was saying to Girish, M, and others, While I am speaking to you, my inner spirit is being awakened. As he uttered those words, Sri Ramakrishna was on the point of entering samadhi. With the utmost difficulty, he tried to control himself. "I still see you," he said, "but I feel as if you had been sitting here forever. I don't recall when you came or where you are." For a few moments, he is silent. Regaining partial consciousness, he said, "I shall have a drink of water." Girish, a newcomer at the time, not knowing this was one of the things Ramakrishna would say to bring his mind down from samadhi, starts after some water. "No, my dear sir," the master explains, "I cannot really drink now." About his coming down from samadhi, he also once said that at such times he could not count correctly. The numbers would come out 1, 7, 8, or something like that. M was present on the day of October of 1885 when Sri Ramakrishna received a visit from an Indian Christian named Mishra, who belonged to the Society of Friends. It would be interesting to know how this man came to be a Quaker. We know little about him, but even that little is sufficient to stimulate curiosity. He had renounced the world when he saw his two brothers killed by the falling of a canopy erected for the wedding ceremony of one of them. Under Western clothes, he wore a sannyasin's ochre loincloth. The master greeted him very warmly, and Mishra's attitude toward him was that of a devotee. Among other things, he told the assembled devotees that he recognized Sri Ramakrishna as God himself, just like Jesus Christ, and that they should do likewise. Further, he said that he had seen the master in a vision as sitting on a raised seat in a garden with another person, less spiritually advanced, sitting on the ground. The Panchavati at Dakshineshwar does, of course, afford just such a scene. In answer to a question put by Ramakrishna, Mishra admitted that he had had a vision of Jesus, compared to the beauty of which a woman's was insignificant. The master soon went out onto the porch of his room. When he returned, he said to the devotees, "I saw him," meaning Mishra, "standing in a heroic posture." At these words, he went into samadhi. When he came out of it, he seized Mishra's hands and told him, "You will get what you are seeking." It is said that while living in this house, Sri Ramakrishna was one day walking to and fro in his room when he saw his subtle body emerge from the gross one. The back of this figure was covered with sores, especially at the neck. Wondering at the cause of these, he was informed by the Divine Mother that these sores were the results of the evil deeds of other persons who had touched him, themselves becoming purified thereby. Quite candidly, he told of this vision to the devotees, it seems. In his mind, there was no trace of importance or apology. Long ago at Dakshineshwar, he had said that he was not afraid to be born thousands of times to do good to living beings. This was Sri Ramakrishna's form of karma yoga. But hearing this, many devotees sought to protect him from the touch of newcomers and also refrained from touching him themselves. The scene now shifts to the Kosipur garden house, to which Sri Ramakrishna was moved on December 11th. The chief reason for this change apparently was the opinion of Dr. Sarkar that the master needed the fresher, purer air of the suburbs. And thus, for the last 8 months of his life, he was able to enjoy the open garden and scenic neighborhood of this large house situated on the eastern side of the road which led from the Bagh Bazar quarter of Calcutta to Baranagar, 3 miles north of the city. The place is hallowed now by the final events which occurred there, especially the bonding of hearts which later led to the formation of the Ramakrishna Martin Mission. The property has been acquired by that organization and his historic house has been restored. His suffering has now become intense. His diet was virtually liquid. The disease, although declared incurable cancer by doctors, could be cured, thought some of the devotees, if the master would only pray to the mother a little for having it cured. His reply was classic. What? Shall this mind, which has been given over totally to God, now be diverted to a worthless shell of a body? The following conversation took place. The devotees, you must cure your illness, for our sake at least. Master, do you think I want to suffer like this? I want to get well. But how is that possible? It depends upon the mother. Narendra, then please pray to her for recovery. She cannot but listen to you. Master, it is easy for you to say that, but I can never utter such words. Narendra, sir, that won't do. You must tell the mother about it, at least for our sake. Master, all right, I shall try to do so if possible. After a few hours, Narendra brought up the subject again. Master, I said to her, I cannot eat anything because of this pain. Please arrange it so I may eat a little. She showed me all of you and said, why, you are eating through so many mouths? I was ashamed and could not utter another word. One is struck with awe, really, at this turn of the event, and we can hardly help feeling that it was indeed clever of the Divine Mother to give such a reply. The master's room was a large one upstairs in the Kosipur house. On the ground floor was a small room where Holy Mother lived, a great improvement over her cramped quarters at Shyampakur. Yet she was busy day and night with so many meals to prepare and persons to think about. She keenly sensed the impending loss of the master and had even undergone a fast and vigil at a famous temple in order to secure a divine remedy with which she hoped to cure his throat. Sarada Devi got her vision, but it turned out quite differently from what she had expected and brought her no prescription. Then Sri Ramakrishna told her of a dream he had had, this being the second of the two dreams we have for the record. He saw that an elephant had gone out to bring medicine for him, and was digging in the earth for it. Suddenly Gopala, child Krishna, woke him up. He inquired of Holy Mother, "Did you see any such dream?" She replied, "I saw Mother Kali with her neck tilted on one side. I asked her why she stood that way. Her answer was, because of his having that trouble, I too am ill." The Holy Mother wept when the Master told her that his mind was constantly remaining absorbed in Brahman. One day, while she was feeding him with thin pudding, he himself burst into tears and exclaimed, "Is this my living on pudding near the end, and so painfully?" Sometime before, he had a vision that this would be his food during his last days. Underlining his above statement to Holy Mother is the confidence which he one evening imparted to M in a low voice. "You see, nowadays it is not necessary for me to meditate much. All at once I become aware of the indivisible Brahman. Nowadays the vision of the Absolute is continuous with me." On December 23rd, the Master informed M that his teaching of others was coming to an end. He was unable to give any more instruction. Since he saw everything as Rama, whom should he teach? Presently, he went into Samadhi, and after returning, he said, "I saw everything passing from form to formlessness. I want to tell you all the things I saw, but I cannot. Well, this tendency of mine towards the formless is only a sign of my nearing dissolution, isn't it? Even now I am seeing the formless, indivisible Satchidananda, just like that. But I have suppressed my feelings with great difficulty." Yet in March of the last year, when his suffering was so acute that the devotees could hardly bear to watch him, he said to Girish, "I am seeing many forms of God. Among them I find this one also," meaning his own. Later, of course, just before the end, he told the still doubting Narendra, "Yes, he who was Rama and Krishna is now in this body Ramakrishna, but not in your Vedantic sense." On the 15th, the next day, he was feeling a little better. Sometimes he talked to the devotees in whispers, sometimes by signs. Most of the conversation of that early morning is pertinent to this record, and we include it here. "Master, do you know what I see right now? I see that it is God Himself who has become all of this. It seems to me that men and other beings are made of leather, and that it is God Himself who, dwelling inside these leather cases, moves the hands, the feet, and the heads. I had a similar vision once before, when I saw houses, gardens, roads, men and cattle, all made of one substance. It was as if they were all made of wax. I see that it is God Himself who has become the block, the executioner, and the victim for the sacrifice." As he describes this staggering experience, he is overwhelmed with emotion and exclaims, "Ah, what a vision!" Immediately, Sri Ramakrishna goes into Samadhi. He completely forgets his body and the outer world, and he says, I have no pain at all. I am my old self again. The devotees are amazed to see this state beyond pleasure and pain. The master casts his glance at Latu and says, there is Loto. He bends his head, resting it on the palm of his hand. I see that it is God himself who rests his head on his hand. Sri Ramakrishna looks at the devotees, and his love for them wells up in a thousand streams. Like a mother showing her tenderness to her children, he touches the faces and chins of Radha and Narendra. A few minutes later, he says to M, if the body were to be preserved a few days more, many people would have their spirituality awakened. He pauses a few minutes. But this is not to be. This time the body will not be preserved. Such is not the will of God. This time the body will not be preserved, lest, finding me guileless and foolish, people should take advantage of me, and lest I, guileless and foolish as I am, should give away everything to everybody. In this Kali Yuga, you see, people are averse to meditation and japa. Rakhal says tenderly, please speak to God that he may preserve your body sometime more. Master, that depends on God's will. Narendra, your will and God's will have become one. Sri Ramakrishna remains silent. He appears to be thinking about something. Master, to Narendra, Rakhal, and the others, and nothing will happen if I speak to God. For now I see that I and the mother have become one. For fear of her sister-in-law, Radha said to Krishna, please dwell in my heart. But when, later on, she became very eager for the vision of Krishna, so eager that her heart pined and panted for her beloved, he would not come out. The devotees sit silently in the room. Sri Ramakrishna looks at them tenderly. Then he places his hand on his heart. He is about to speak. Master, there are two persons in this. One, the Divine Mother. He pauses. The devotees eagerly look at him to hear what he will say next. Master, yes, one is she, and the other is her devotee. It is the devotee who broke his arm, and it is the devotee who is now ill. Do you understand? The devotees sit without uttering a word. Master, alas, to whom shall I say all this? Who will understand me? Pausing a few moments, he says, God becomes man, an avatar, and comes to earth with his devotees, and the devotees leave the world with him. Rakhal, therefore we pray that you may not go away and leave us behind. Sri Ramakrishna smiles and says, a band of minstrels suddenly appears, dances, and sings, and it departs in the same sudden manner. They come and they return, but no one recognizes them. In April, he had a visit from a young man very dear to him, named Hirananda, who had come all the way from his home in the province of Sindh to see him. In the course of their talk, Sri Ramakrishna said to M, "I don't remember when the current went up. Now I am in the mood of a child. That is why I am playing with the flowers this way. Do you know what I see now? I see my body as a frame made of bamboo strips and covered with a cloth. The frame moves, and it moves because someone dwells within it. Again, I see the body to be like a pumpkin with the seed scooped out. Inside this body, there is no trace of passion or worldly attachment. It is all very clean inside, and it became very painful." Sri Ramakrishna to talk further. He felt very weak. M quickly guessed what the master wanted to tell the devotees and said, "And you are seeing God inside yourself, Master, both inside and outside. The indivisible Satchidananda, I see it both inside and outside. It has merely assumed this sheath, his body, for a support, and exists both inside and outside. I clearly perceive this now." M and Hirananda listened intently to these words about his exalted state of God consciousness. A few moments later, Sri Ramakrishna looked at them and resumed the conversation. "Master, you all seem to be my kinsmen. I do not look on any of you as a stranger. I see you all as so many sheaths, and the heads are moving. I notice that when my mind is united with God, the suffering of the body is left aside. Now I perceive only this. The indivisible Satchidananda is covered with skin, and this sore in the throat is on one side of it." Even the gospel is silent from May until the day of the Master's death on the 15th of August, 1886, or by Western reckoning, the 16th. For at 1:02 a.m., Sri Ramakrishna gave up the experience of this fragile world and, entering Mahasamadhi, returned to the Eternal Mother from whom he came. His play was done. "I have practiced," Sri Ramakrishna had said, "all kinds of sadhana, jnana yoga, karma yoga, bhakti yoga. I have even gone through the exercises of hatha yoga. Many views, many paths, and I have seen them all. But I don't enjoy them anymore. They all quarrel. I have come to the final realization that God is the whole and I am a part of Him, that God is the Master and I am His servant. And furthermore, sometimes I feel that He is I and I am He." Epilogue. When the compilation of Sri Ramakrishna's visions was begun, it was expected that the approach would be an analytic one, somewhat in the manner of the psychologist. If the reader will look back, he may note that in each case where it is known, we have mentioned the exact place where Sri Ramakrishna was at the time of his vision, the position which he was assuming, whether seated, standing, walking, and so on, whether his eyes were closed or open, how long approximately he was absorbed in the experience, the time of day, and the particular aspect of divine being with which the vision was concerned. The kind of imagery occurring and the effect upon the master, where known, were also taken into account. One reason for this approach was the expectation that from all this a kind of pattern might be visible, some correlation between external circumstances and internal content, or some indication of the particular conditions which may have created in the master a predisposition to have a certain type of superconscious experience. Now that all the evidence available is in one place, we think it can justly be said that no such pattern or correlation is discernible. It is true that most of his reported visions occurred in the daytime rather than at night, but this can be explained, at least in part, by the fact that in the daytime there were people around to report them to. Furthermore, he said one day to Swami Sharadananda, "When alone during the last hours of the night I am engaged in thinking of your good, Mother reveals everything about you to me, how far each one of you has progressed, what blocks the further progress of anyone to spirituality, and so on." Also, we do not find much evidence of his having visions while in a reclining posture. On the other hand, M. very often tells us in his book that the master suddenly stood up and went into samadhi. Apart from this, it seems as clear as ever that superconscious experience could possess Sri Ramakrishna at any place, at any time, whether he was meditating on Mother Kali in a temple, or watching a lion at the zoo, or riding in a carriage, or walking to the pine grove to answer the call of nature. Every kind of imagery is involved in the content of his visions, although, as we should expect, visual and auditory predominate. In the content of those reported, he is seen to be in contact with virtually every prominent aspect of the Indian pantheon and the forms of other religions also. Who knows how many he may have seen of which he said nothing? His samadhi might last anywhere from a few months to days and weeks. The slightest suggestion, sacred or to us secular, could throw him into that mood, whereas once within it his mind could be disengaged again, more easily by some methods than by others. This astounding buoyancy of Sri Ramakrishna's mind, rising at once to these heights in response to the slight touch of the most varied religious stimuli, was characteristic of it from his very childhood. Maturity brought little more than the constant difficulty of holding it down. A chronological account, therefore, of the psychic life of Sri Ramakrishna does not appear to show the features of evolutionary development which might be expected from our knowledge of the lives of other saints and sages. Saint John of the Cross has his dark night. Saint Teresa feels the water of spiritual consciousness rising at one point to the level of her neck. Contemplatives plow deeper and deeper into the soil of the realm of the spirit. There is a history in the mental and spiritual life of the master, but so many of the things which make up the history of a saint happened so early in his life, or were unnecessary entirely, that whatever development we can trace is of a subtle and extraordinary sort. It almost defies analysis. One gets the feeling of a drama whose performance came first and dress rehearsal afterwards, with its prompters, props, and a few onlookers. Sri Ramakrishna's personality had a quality of simplicity about it, which is, in a sense, deceptive. Probably this compilation shows as clearly as anything can the complex and singular nature with which we are dealing. No doubt throughout history it will be argued whether at Dakshineswar there lived a hysteric, a seer, a mystic, a saint, an incarnation, or God Himself. All these are words, and as the perceptive poet reminds us, words strain, crack, and sometimes break under the burden, under the tension, slip, slide, perish, decay with imprecision, will not stay in place, will not stay still. It will not greatly matter. The phenomenon is here before us, and we cannot but stand in awe of it.